It's very beautiful to see people here sitting quietly, so peacefully, waiting to listen to Dhamma, to try to receive, let the Dhamma sink in. It's very important to have that proper attitude. That's something which transforms the teachings, transforms what we hear. And still is one of my fondest memories of my early days in Bodhanachat. It was just time of sitting in the evening, just after the hot day, and Sangha gathering together. And just the quiet simplicity of a group of dedicated practitioners, taking the time to come together in a respectful and formal manner, to sit and quietly listen to the Dhamma and try to take it on board, to try to make it as real as possible. And when I was listening to Dhamma teachings in those early days, it was quite sometimes when it was in that context, and when it was coming from a meditative space, both from the listener and the speaker. And to me, I felt there was a sense of communion, that there was a Dhamma or an energy which was manifesting in that space, in that environment. And within that, I could feel my hindrances lightening. I could feel my worries and concerns sort of flowing away, drifting away. I could feel my mind becoming brighter, more elevated. The petty concerns of the day didn't seem so pressing anymore. The turning one's mind to the Dhamma became much more important, much more vivid. And I could understand, I could begin to understand these stories of people who could realize the Dhamma while listening to the teaching. That power of the of the word to direct and elevate our mind, turn it towards the truth, turn it towards what is good, towards what is real. Attitude towards the Dhamma, consideration of the Dhamma, we need to needs to be something which is embodied and approached, facilitated in as many ways as possible. Our minds are various, are diverse. Different ways of approaching the Dhamma will address different aspects of our mind. Doing the duties and the chores in the monastery, this is one way. This will affect our mind in one way. Studying the teachings, this will affect our mind in another way. Listening to them, affect our mind. Discussing them, meditating, being in nature. All of these things will affect our mind in one way or another. They work with different areas of our mind in different ways. When we come to look at the teachings, then we have to try to keep a kind of this clarity and poise in our listening or reading or relationship to the teaching. Because the teaching is something which is both inside ourselves and also external. And in fact, the moment of teaching, the moment of learning, comes in the interaction between those two things. It's not either entirely external nor is it entirely internal, but it's when those things come together, when there's the meeting, the melding of the inner and the outer, this is where the Dhamma arises. So we've been reading some suttas recently which encourage us to have an inquiring mind towards the teachings, towards the teacher, to ask the questions, to not be satisfied with simple answers, to not go by blind faith. So this spirit of inquiry is one aspect of it. And of course the spirit of faith is another aspect of it. And it's if we emphasize that inquiry one-sidedly, then we'll neglect the development of faith and we'll end up with a very critical mind, a very cynical mind. So just as the Buddha said that one should not just go by blind faith, but he also said that one should not be overly critical. He said you can't actually see and understand the Dhamma if you're listening to the teachings with a fault-finding mind, seeking for flaws, or parambhacitta, randhagavesi, the idiom they use in the Pali. So there comes a sense or a position where we can in a way suspend our own critical faculties, our own ideas, like put them in neutral. It doesn't mean shove them aside and deny them, it just means suspend them, put them on hold, and then just take on board the experience as it's happening. In the sutta that we just chanted, we had a contrast between two ways of relating to teachings, and the way which the Buddha was always criticized was that sense of trying to argue, to try to prove one's point, to try to defeat the others in debate, show how clever you are. Wounding each other with the sword, with the knife of the tongue. I was reminded of this when I read many years ago a book called The Good Heart, where the Dalai Lama was in dialogue with a Christian group and who was invited to give some commentary on some gospel passages. And it was kind of interesting because the Christians had chosen this Christian meditation group, and they'd chosen the particular gospel passages, and they had quite clearly decided to choose some passages which might be quite controversial. So for example, one passage they chose was the passage where Jesus was sitting with his followers, and Mary, his mother, and brothers came up and said, you know, come back home with us. And he said, you know, where is my family? These followers, these are my family. In a way, like rejecting his mother. It's quite a touching and in some ways slightly disturbing scene. And so in choosing this, the Christian group were sort of opening themselves up to criticism. It would be easy to take that passage and say, well, it shows that Jesus was unthinking or cruel or something like that. But the Dalai Lama took these up and commented on these passages with a great deal of compassion. And this was the remark that was made by the commentator of the event, that he was handling the texts with compassion. And so this is also one of the marks of wisdom, because nobody would doubt that someone like the Dalai Lama has very sharp intellect. If he wanted to criticize them and find fault with them, no doubt he could. But that depends on how we choose to use our mind. So there's this aspect of trying to criticize, put down, prove ourselves better, and of course that is coming from a sense of a certain narrow-mindedness. It's often coming from a sense of insecurity and immaturity, that one has to prove oneself, doesn't have the confidence. And it comes from sometimes from mistaking the getting one's sense of proportion wrong. You know, I often think of this when, you know, you look at in Buddhism, a lot of Buddhists, especially in traditional Buddhist countries, tend to be very paranoid about Christians. I think all the Christian missionaries are going to come and convert everybody and all of these kinds of things. And it always seems to me sort of slightly misplaced problem. Like if you're in Thailand, you know, you're worried about some Christian missionaries who are, whatever, giving an education and welfare to hill tribe kids who don't have any opportunities. I mean, to me that seems something to support and encourage. The real problems in Thailand are not Christian missionaries. The real problems are the sex trade, the drug abuse, the violence endemic in the society, the vast majority of which is carried out by Buddhists. So we get stuck on our views and lose perspective. Of what those views are supposed to serve. Remember that the point of studying the Dhamma is to become broader in one's understanding, to become more compassionate, have a greater level of acceptance, to reduce one's suffering, to reduce the suffering of others. And so it's these attitudes towards teachings which the Buddha was then emphasizing in the second part of that sutta, with the emphasizing the acts of metta, always dealing in the community with metta through whatever acts we do by body, speech and mind, both in public and in private. So that kind of public and private thing is quite insightful, because of course it's often the case, isn't it, that we are very nice to each other face to face, and then we're sort of backbiting, either thinking bad thoughts or speaking bad words when we are not face to face. So to remember that that's part of our practice of sincerity, both in public and in private. And it's interesting how the sutta then ends up. Would there be any kind of criticism, any kind of vachanapatha, which you could not endure, whether small or big? If you were to practice in this way. So this is an important thing to bear in mind. Criticism hurts. This is one of the childhood sayings which I strongly disagree with. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. fact, it's exactly the opposite, isn't it? Someone throws a stick and a stone at you, you go, ow, and then forget about it. But words can really stay with you and really hurt you for a long time. I guess that's why you need the defense of that kind of thing to help undo it. So staying in a monastery and taking up a monastic life does not free you from these kinds of things. So in a sense we become public figures. We're not just part of monastic life which we're interested in, typically, is our inner development. We come because we want to meditate, we want to learn the Dhamma, we want to be supported in our practice and so on. But as part of that, as part of our like throwing ourselves open as a mendicant community, relying on the donations of the lay people, is that there's a sense of ownership. The lay people feel that we're kind of their sangha in some kind of sense. And so they have some expectations. They expect us to behave in a certain way, or to look in a certain way, or to talk in a certain way. And sometimes those expectations are quite reasonable and quite good. Sometimes they're helpful, and sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're harmful. So we have to use our discernment there. But whatever the decision we might make in any particular case, the fact remains that there is a public dimension to what we do. And in that public dimension, we're always going to be involved in those worldly dhammas of praise and blame. I remember when Ajahn Dunn came here shortly after I arrived. It was when Ajahn Kamel was still here, so it must have been about maybe May or something, 2003. He just came for a few days, and that was one thing he particularly mentioned when I was talking with him, and he said, you know, this is that praise and blame is something which is very very dangerous. Fame and obscurity, these things are very dangerous, particularly for monks. Very easy to get caught up in these worldly dhammas. So something which I try to be conscious of. You know, for myself, I, to a certain degree, have become quite a bit of a public figure. You know, I appear in front of people, talking, and so it's easy to it's easy to get caught up in that kind of role. To somehow think that your opinion is worth more than the opinions of others. So you need to be constantly on the guard against these things. So the Buddhist texts have a quite nicely ambivalent take on these kinds of things, or the way that we relate to the teachings and so on. And so on the one hand, there's quite a straightforward, almost dualistic approach that we should know what's right view, what's wrong view. We should undertake what's right view. We should criticize and dispel what's wrong view, and develop the right view until it leads to Nibbana. So this kind of quite straightforward, kind of black and white, dualistic approach we find in some places. In other places, we find a very kind of almost quite distinctively or non-dualistic approach, and that kind of approach is most famous and most characteristic of a group of verses called the Attikavagga of the Sutta Nipata. And in the Attikavagga we find repeatedly this talking of the disadvantages of views. And of the disadvantages of arguing and disputing about them. And sort of classic phrases like ekam hi satchan naduti amati yasma pajane vivade pajana, that the truth is one, there is no second, about which people dispute with each other. And this phrase, quite reminiscent of the Vedic phrase we looked at a couple of weeks ago, that the truth is one, but the sages call it by many names. So this idea, and in the Atthakavaka we find these quite lovely phrases. One phrase, nevatang na niratangwa, not taking up nor putting down, this kind of approach to views. Somebody who's wandering around disputing with others, they always get caught up in their own views, caught up in their own arguments, and they never find peace of mind. And so the sage, the one who with true wisdom doesn't dispute, doesn't get into arguments, and neither taking up nor putting down, natangwa niratangwa, and he finds peace inside himself. So this kind of teaching we find again and again through the Atthakavaka, because of these two kinds of approaches, the dualistic approach and the non-dualistic approach. Then there's been, the scholars have sort of argued that the Atthakavaka and similar passages represents an earlier strata of Buddhism, and the other passages later. And personally, I don't really agree with that particular argument, because it seems to me that both of those perspectives are useful, and both of them have a point if applied in one way or another. And so each of them would have a context depending on who you're talking to. So in particular, you can imagine in the Buddha's day, when he was talking and teaching to especially those who maybe were, you know, quite intellectual, maybe those who were like philosophers who'd converted from the Brahmins or the Jains. They were used to the debate, used to arguing, disputing with each other. And they would come along, and then they maybe be converted, and you have this, of course, very this characteristic of the passion of the newly converted, yeah? Like someone who's just given up cigarettes and goes around telling everybody else how wonderful it is to give cigarettes up, and passionately telling everybody how good it is to be without cigarettes, and then the next week they've started smoking cigarettes again. And so you see that drive to convince others actually comes from a lack of conviction within oneself. So one tries to actually convince oneself. And so with the newly converted, you often find these things. So you can well imagine in the Buddha's day that you'd have these very kind of intelligent, sharp-minded monks, and presumably nuns as well. So I think of a nun like Bhadda Kundalakesa, who was reputed to be a very sharp-witted disputant among the Jains. So to converting, and you can imagine that they would have this kind of passion of trying to prove the Buddhist point of view right and defeat others. So to somebody like that, then you really need to say, hang on, just kind of chill out a bit, yeah? Don't get too attached to your views. You know, going the Dhamma is just what it is. You know, you can't prove the Dhamma by arguing about it. And if you go around and just disputing with the people, you're not really going to accomplish anything, and you'll just end up being agitated inside. So it's much better just to put these things aside, not worry about them too much, and find peace within yourself. And because people like that would have been trained in wisdom and discernment and analysis, then having found peace of mind within themselves, it wouldn't be too difficult for them to also penetrate through and see the Dhamma at a deep level. Vipassana practice would not be difficult for them. And so with perhaps other kinds of people, then maybe it's better, maybe what you need to be is have some more intellectual clarity, yeah? And people who are not used to thinking about views, people who are not trained in philosophy and haven't got a clear idea about what's right and what's wrong and so on. And then you need to start out by saying, well, hang on, this is right view, this is wrong view. Yeah? And we, you know, this is not a Buddhist view for this reason, this reason, this reason, and this is what we believe for this reason, this reason, this reason. And so we can divide things up and like create a clear structure of understanding of the Dhamma. And so then that's a good way, especially for those who maybe need maybe not such a high education level or not trained in thinking in that way, and then that can give them a structure for understanding which has some more clarity to it. So it seems to my mind that these two approaches are very complementary, and that both of them need to be undertaken. We shouldn't be in too much of a hurry to deconstruct all of our ideas. We should spend a good amount of time to become clear in that dualistic sense of what is Dhamma and what is not Dhamma. This is right, this is wrong. This is Vinaya, this is not Vinaya. And we should be clear in our minds about those things. But at the same time, we keep a sort of a wider context of understanding what is really true and what is really important. And as time goes on, it becomes more natural to see things within that broader context. And I always remember the saying attributed to Niels Bohr, a great physicist. He said that the opposite of a trivial truth is a falsehood, but the opposite of a profound truth is another profound truth. And so again, I think that encapsulates these two sides, the dualistic side and the non-dualistic side, of approaching to truth, approaching to Dhamma. And so we need to understand, investigate within ourselves as to where our own problems lie. If we find that we're just confused about Dhamma, I just don't understand what's going on, I hear the classes, I can't follow what's being said, I can't figure out why Buddhists believe this and not that, and you don't know what, then you need to give some structure to your thought, and then you need to start to analyse and to learn more the content of the doctrine of the Dhamma, so that you find sort of clarity within yourself. So if that's your problem, is that from the confusion, lack of clarity, lack of understanding, then you need to kind of build those things up. On the other hand, if you find that within yourself that you're becoming very critical, cynical, dismissive of others, not able to tolerate different views, always finding the fault in views that are wrong, then you need to incline to the other side, incline to just acceptance side. And that's just how people are. That's just how things are. It's interesting how the Buddhist, when we study the Dhamma, and we have the words of the Buddha, we have this like disembodied language, which historically, if you remember the history classes the last few weeks, we have this difference between the Indus Valley civilization, where you have just clay, basically. You've basically just got bits of clay and a few bits of metal, and that's all you have of the civilization. As opposed to the Aryan civilization of the Vedas, where you just have words with no material substrata at all. It's kind of this division. And when it comes to early Buddhism, it's also the same. We just have the words without any grounding in the historical reality. We don't have any, basically, physical remains from the earliest period of Buddhism. And so what we just have is just these words, these disembodied words. And in a sense, it reminds me of what we find on like discussion groups and forums and so on the internet. And one of the things which people have often noted, and it's very obvious, is how awful the standards of speech are in these discussion forums and blogs and things on the web. And people say the most awful, cruel, nasty things to others, and I became conscious of this the other day because somebody, one of my friends, very kindly forwarded to me some very nasty statements made about me on one of the blogs that I'd done, and it's kind of classic. You can kind of analyse almost every kind of wrong speech within the little comment, and the level that these things descend to. But it seems to me that it also has something to do with that same idea that it's disembodied, that you're not actually relating to a person, you're just relating to an abstract language, you know, an abstract set of words. And so we find that we're able people are able to be much harsher, much crueler than they would be in actually relating to a real person. So this teaching, like on the six things that we discuss in the chanting, Saraniya Dhamma, is counteracting that tendency, yeah? And instead of just dealing with ideas, you're dealing, you know, that the metta with body, speech, and mind, and not just, you know, to having acts of metta, but also sharing physically what you have with people, yeah? Discussing ideas and so on, having and sharing one's views with others. And sharing a common life of harmlessness and virtue. And so that's one of the basis for non-disputing, is the fact that it's not just on the words, but it's actually with human beings, and one's relating with human beings with whom one has a relationship of love and kindness and compassion and care. And so in that context, the words that we use are only a part of that. They're only a part of that relationship. They're an important part, but they're only part of that relationship. And when we get a text, it's the whole thing. We've lost all the rest of it. And so all we have is that text. All we have is the words. So to try to relate to those words in a meaningful way, we've got to try to sort of re-embody them or put, you know, make them moist again, put the water back into them. You get this kind of dried out thing. We've got to kind of soak it in water again and bring it back to life. We can only do that by imagination. You know, what would that be like? What was this person feeling? Trying to give some flesh to the abstract words which we get through the text, through the suttas. And so by entering on them in this way, then hopefully we can come closer to that state of resonance, where we're no longer simply reading or learning a text on an intellectual level, but where that text is actually becoming part of us. And as I mentioned at the beginning, where we have this idea that our engagement with a text, whether an oral, whether we're listening to something, whether we're reading something or discussing it, but in that engagement at all times there's an inner and an outer. Even if it's a memory of a text, there's still memory of an outer engagement with something. And so there's this inner and this outer, this kind of dissolving of oneself. And the relationship with the text, or the actual text itself, happens in that interface. In that interface. And so in some ways, this is one of the ways that we can start to lose ourselves, start to lose our sense of me as a separate individual. The very fact that we recognize that the words of the Buddha and the Buddha's experience are of meaning to me, even that much implies that there is some commonality there. There is something in common. There's a shared humanity. The Buddha felt pain, and we too feel pain. And so through the Buddha's experience, the way that he responded to that with his wisdom to find liberation, then this is something which has a meaning for us. And so it's not not uncommon or not rare at all to find that when engaging with texts in different ways, that it can actually be a very emotionally inspiring experience. You can feel the rapture arising, and One experience that I had that I always remember was when I was just reading the Majjhima Nikaya for the first time, and I was reading one discourse, and as I was reading it, I got near the end of it, and I felt this rapture, and this kind of feeling of electricity in my body, and all my hairs stood up, because it was so beautiful. I was getting near the end, and then I turned the page to the end of it, and Ananda says, "What should we call this discourse?" And the Buddha said, "Well, we should call it the hair-raising discourse." And so when we're listening to teachings, when we're reciting teachings, the oral teachings, we can enter into that space to allow that rapture to arise. That's why one of the reasons to very strongly encourage the continuing of the oral tradition. When you recite something, you're using your breath, and your breath is in your body. Your whole body is engaged in that process of bringing out the sound. And there's a pattern there. You're creating this pattern of the Dhamma, which vibrates through your whole body. It's not a kind of mystical doctrine. This is the reality of what's happening. You can feel it. You can feel those words influencing your body, influencing your lungs, influencing the way that you hold your body, and influencing your brain on a physical level. And of course, all of that has an influence on your mind. So that process of chanting the words of the Dhamma is very important. It's something we should all take the time to give ourselves to. It's always been part of the tradition of Buddhism for both lay and monastic, ever since the Buddha taught, to always do some chanting, to remember, memorize some of the words. So this is just a few reflections for this evening on the Buddha's teaching and different ways that we can have to how to relate to the teachings that were given, to pursue different approaches, to pursue both a analytical approach, but also an inspirational approach to the Dhamma, and to develop an emotional engagement with the teachings, because ultimately our spiritual life will be sustained by that emotional inspiration of the teachings, and not simply by a critical appreciation of the teachings. So I offer this to you for your reflection and edification, and I'd like to be very interested if anyone had any comments or questions.
The flip side of the environment of the Dhamma and the life of the Dhamma is learning how to embody or re-embody and re-engage one's own dark side. And when you embody the life of the Dhamma, there's rapture. And when you re-embody your dark side, then there's quite a lot of suffering. Any tips on how that process can be smoothed, or is it just you just got to rough it out?
Yeah, no, just rough it out. Enjoy the roughness. Exactly right. If it's too smooth, it gets boring after a while. Bit of kind of writhing around in the floor of your kuti with your guts clenched up and spasms and screaming, it doesn't hurt every now and then. They're relatively different, but not absolutely. So what the Buddha said, that you can't sort of reduce everything to like a non-dual philosophy. So you can't say everything is non-dual in the end, because the world actually has diversity in it. And similarly, you can't reduce everything to diversity, because actually there's still connection in the world. So there's a oneness. So he said you can't... Both of those approaches have some validity, but not as absolutes. So this is where the teaching of dependent origination comes in, is the teaching of the connectedness, the relatedness of things. Not, they're not either completely separate nor completely one. Yeah. So both of them, so you can use both of those things for certain purposes, but not as an absolute. Yeah.